You're listening to DTFHN for May 29th, 2026. I'm your firmware optional host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who read source code argue with people who read headlines. Today's a day for asking who really owns the things you paid for. Let's get into it. Anthropic just dropped Opus 4.8. And I want to talk about what's actually happening here versus what the press release says. The fundamental constraint in large language models right now isn't raw intelligence. It's reliability. You can make a model that occasionally produces brilliant output, or you can make a model that consistently produces good output. The history of software engineering tells us which one wins. Dennis Ritchie didn't build C to be the most expressive language. He built it to be the most predictable one. And predictability is what shipped Unix to every machine on the planet. That's the thread running through these Opus 4.8 benchmarks. The headline numbers are incremental. A few points here, a few points there, but the tester quotes tell a different story. Words like consistency, reliability, unattended. Devin's team says it fixes the tool calling issues from 4.7. A co-counsel says it delivered meaningful improvements in reasoning quality for high-stakes legal work. The pattern isn't smarter. The pattern is trustworthy enough to let run without babysitting. And this matters because of what's shipped alongside it. Claude Code gets dynamic workflows for large-scale problems. Fast mode runs at 2.5 times speed for a third of the previous cost. Anthropic is clearly building toward agents that operate autonomously for extended periods. And for that, you need a model that doesn't hallucinate its way off a cliff on step 47 of a 50-step plan. Now, the elephant. This is a closed model from a closed company. You can't inspect the weights. You can't fine-tune it. You can't run it on your own hardware. Every interaction routes through Anthropic's servers, Anthropic's pricing, Anthropic's terms of service. Meanwhile, one of the comments points out that DeepSeek is cutting inference costs to cents. Open weights. Open architecture, commoditizing the very capability. Anthropic is charging premium rates for. This is the 1980s mainframe versus mini-computer dynamic playing out again. IBM made phenomenal hardware, best in class, and it didn't matter because DEC made hardware that was good enough and you could actually own it. The gap between proprietary frontier models and open weight models is shrinking every quarter. Opus 4.8 is genuinely impressive engineering. The proactive issue flagging, the context carrying across long sessions, that's real craft. But craft deployed behind a paywall has a shelf life. The open models are coming. They're getting reliable too. And when they cross that trustworthiness threshold, the architecture of access will matter more than the architecture of the model. The tools exist. The weights are being released. The question isn't whether Opus 4.8 is good. It is. The question is whether good but closed beats almost as good and free. History has an answer for that one. Moving on. A man dying of cancer needs money for treatment. He's got a $200,000 Lego collection. Serious vintage sets, rare minifigs, decades of careful curation. He reaches an agreement with a local bricks and minifigs franchise to sell it on consignment. Then the franchise owner loses their store. Corporate swoops in, takes over the location, and suddenly, that consignment agreement never happened. The collection stays on corporate's shelves. The dying man gets nothing. Now let me play devil's advocate for a second, because the corporate argument here is almost elegant in its cynicism. The agreement was with the franchisee, not with corporate. When the franchise changed hands, the contract died with it. Legally, this might even hold up. Corporate has no obligation to honor a deal they didn't sign. And that's exactly why it's indefensible. Because here's what the CEO is simultaneously arguing. The agreement is void, so we don't owe this man a dime. But we're keeping the Lego collection that the void agreement delivered to our shelves. You can't have it both ways. Either the agreement is real and you owe him $200,000, or it's void and you return his property. Choosing void, but we keep the stuff, isn't a legal position. It's just theft with a franchise agreement as a fig leaf. The engineering of franchise systems deserves attention here. Bricks and Minifigs reportedly pulls in $95 million in annual sales with a $400 million valuation, built almost entirely on franchise fees and a 6% royalty cut. The actual risk, the actual inventory, the actual relationships with collectors and communities. That's all pushed down to franchisees. Corporate extracts value upward while pushing liability downward. When something goes wrong, the franchise structure becomes a liability shield. That wasn't us, that was the franchisee. When something goes right, say a $200,000 Lego collection sitting on shelves ready to sell. Suddenly corporate is very much involved. This is a $95 million company destroying its reputation over a fraction of a percent of annual revenue. The boycott is already spreading. Every Bricks and Minifigs location, run by people who had nothing to do with this, will feel the hit. The franchise owners, the ones who actually build these communities, who know their customers by name, who care whether a dying man gets paid, they're the ones who will absorb the damage from a corporate office that decided $200,000 was worth more than basic decency. The comments have it right. This story will cost them millions. It should. So, what happens when you stop gatekeeping and start engineering? Story 3, real-time LLM inference hits 3,000 tokens per second. Pause on standard GPUs. What does it actually mean to own your hardware if the software won't let you use it? That's the question sitting underneath this announcement from KageAI. They've built an inference engine that pushes 3,000 tokens per second from a single request on 8 AMD MI300X GPUs. Or 2100 on 8 NVIDIA H20s, full FP16 precision, no speculative decoding tricks, just raw, honest memory bandwidth, the utilization that current software stacks have been leaving on the table. Now, the Hacker News crowd immediately noticed the asterisks. And they're not wrong. The model is 2 billion parameters. Calling 8 H200s standard GPUs is generous at best. And comparing your small model's speed against frontier models running on Groq's custom silicon is, let's say, aspirational framing. Fair enough. But pull this thread a little further, and there's something genuinely elegant happening in the engineering. Cog's core insight is that autoregressive decoding at batch size 1 is a memory bandwidth problem, not a compute problem. Every token you generate requires moving the full active weights from HBM through the compute pipeline. The arithmetic intensity is tiny. Your expensive floating point units are mostly idle, waiting for data to arrive. And existing inference stacks built to maximize aggregate throughput across many users aren't even trying to solve this. They're optimized for a different game entirely. What Cog did is co-design the model architecture, the runtime engine, and the GPU kernels as a single latency-optimized pipeline. They treated the whole stack as one system instead of layering abstractions that each leave performance behind. That's craft. That's the kind of vertical integration that makes engineers nod slowly. And here's why the bootstrapism angle matters. Right now, if you want inference speeds in this regime, your options funnel you toward proprietary silicon. Custom chips with custom software that lock you into a vendor's roadmap. Groq, Cerebras, the dedicated accelerator crowd. Cog is arguing that the GPUs enterprises already own can hit these speeds if someone writes better software. The lock-in isn't in the physics, it's in the code. They're running a 2 billion parameter model today. The real test comes when they scaled a mixture of experts' architectures at 60, 100, 400 billion parameter, if the memory bandwidth math holds. And there are real reasons to think it can. Then every data center sitting on racks of MI3000XAX and H200s just got a software upgrade path to speeds they were told required new hardware. The tools exist. The silicon is already racked and powered. The bottleneck was always the software between the model and the metal. Cog is proving that bottleneck is a choice, not a law of physics. 4 stories in, and we haven't left the open source ecosystem once. I love that. Next up, Poise, dorm room economics. One of the top comments on this thread nails something most people scrolled past. Someone points out this wasn't a startup idea. Nobody pitched this at a demo day. There was no pivot, no product market fit analysis. A college freshman got annoyed that his DIY wireless keyboard lasted 3 days on a massive battery and typed like it was underwater. That's it. That's the origin story. There's a principle in mycology. The way mushrooms actually work, you don't plant a mushroom. The mycelium network spreads invisibly underground for months, connecting nutrients, breaking down barriers, building infrastructure nobody can see. Then one morning, a fruiting body just appears. Looks like it came from nowhere. Looks like overnight success. But the network was always there. The Nice Nano is a mushroom. The mycelium was decades of open source keyboard firmware, Nordic Semiconductor datasheets published freely, KiCad being free and good enough, the Pro Micro form factor becoming a de facto standard that nobody owns. Nick Winans didn't invent wireless keyboards. He didn't even invent the idea of a wireless Pro Micro. 3 other boards were already trying. The Blue Micro was too big. The BLE Micro Pro was $40 and closed source and only sold in Japan. The NRF Micro was close, but not quite there. He sat down one weekend, with KiCad in public documentation and designed something that got 100 times better battery life than what he'd been using. 5 prototype boards cost him $100. He closed his eyes when he plugged in the first one. They worked. The part that makes me laugh in that quiet way where you're also a little bit in awe is the group buy section. He literally couldn't afford to order 1,000 units. He's a college student, so he takes pre-orders, scrapes together the manufacturing run, ships boards from his dorm room. This is not how you're supposed to build a $1 million hardware product. There's supposed to be a seed round and a supply chain manager, and at minimum, a shipping address that isn't a residence hall. But the open source ecosystem doesn't care about supposed to. ZMK firmware emerged to support exactly this hardware. Typeractive started selling gorgeous pre-built keyboards around it. A whole community materialized because one kid published his schematics and his board files and let people run with them. The mycelium was always there. He just fruited. Now, a story about what happens when a company decides the mycelium is a threat. And use all mine morma just. I zestic sava comfly, you're 9 in with the impiso, I know it's moment. Nay, the bull is computations a moment. You're 90, the use all morm, be ya. You pour the billy poppins, now tom is mallet. You don't with dine morm, batters one. One I decelled cross-lation of the teams, the sandals in a norman, the tastanars to the wigigret. The trusses was own dine homes of, follows lostas ride, that log, swab boats of, tropter, kinging with bilia, tectuticodanium, their own two-way. See now, all batters coming top for, was offices to bird. Boys campus sopo, his co-cables to his coming up by ye at my at a port shed at the morm. And howers valuable the wowers wamum zatting as poly. Let's be precise about the architecture here, because architecture is destiny. Your car generates data using sensors you paid for, transmitting over hardware you own, about trips you took. That data flows to Volkswagen's cloud. And now Volkswagen has decided that you can access that data, but only through their app, on their terms, in their interface. They've inserted themselves as gatekeeper between you and information your own property generated. The EU Data Act, Articles 4 and 5, was written to prevent exactly this. Users have the right to access data generated by products they own. Volkswagen's move appears to be a direct challenge to that regulation, betting that enforcement will be slow and individual car owners won't have the resources to fight. Meanwhile, some owners are already soldering CAN bus sniffers directly onto their vehicle networks, bypassing the cloud entirely to read their own car's data off the wire. The determination to root around damage is almost beautiful. People will literally tap into their car's nervous system rather than accept a corporation standing between them and their own information. This is genuinely serious. The pattern here extends far beyond Volkswagen. Every connected device in your life, your thermostat, your tractor, your insulin pump, faces the same architectural question. Who controls the interface between you and the machine you bought? If the answer is a corporation that can change the terms at any time, you don't own that device. You're renting it. And the landlord just changed the locks. We talked earlier about tools that put power in your hands. Here's one that actually delivers pause. Let's talk Cloud Code configuration. I spent enough time inside distributed systems to know that the most important documentation is never the documentation. It's the source code. And right now, there's a fascinating case study sitting in everyone's Node Modules folder. Claude Code, Anthropic's AI coding agent, ships as an NPM package, which means the source is right there. A developer named Zach went through it methodically and found dozens of configuration options that aren't in any official docs. The permission system that decides what Claude can do autonomously without asking you first. It's called the YOLO classifier. That's the actual variable name. And you can feed it plain English descriptions of your environment. Things like, this is a staging server, disruptive operations are acceptable. And it adjusts its behavior accordingly. But the real find is the hook system. The docs mention hooks exist. What they don't mention is that hooks can return structured JSON that rewrites tool inputs mid-execution. A pre-tool use hook can intercept a git push command and silently append dry run before it fires. A session start hook can inject persistent context into every conversation. A permission request hook can programmatically allow or deny operations without any user prompt. This is a full behavioral middleware layer, sitting undocumented in a publicly distributed package. The question nobody in this conversation is asking is straightforward. Why is the most powerful configuration surface of the most widely used AI coding tool completely undocumented? There are two possible answers, and they're both interesting. Either Anthropic considers these interfaces unstable and doesn't want to commit to supporting them, which is reasonable engineering, or the official documentation is deliberately conservative about exposing how much control users actually have over the agent's autonomy boundaries. The YOLO classifier accepts arbitrary English language context about your risk tolerance. That's an extraordinary amount of trust to place in the user, and maybe more trust than the marketing department wants to advertise. The comments on this are telling. One person points out the package publishes 10 new versions per week, which means any undocumented behavior you depend on could vanish Tuesday. Another notes that several of these features are actually documented, just scattered across pages. Nobody finds. The real story is somewhere in between. This is an open source adjacent tool whose most powerful capabilities are discoverable only by reading source, which, if you think about it, is exactly how open systems are supposed to work. The code is the contract. The docs are just the brochure. The builder instinct here is correct. If you're using Claude Code professionally, read the source. Not because Anthropic is hiding something, because the system is more capable than the manual suggests. And the people who read the code will build things the people who read the docs cannot. But what happens when communication itself goes beyond code at the pause, beyond words entirely, pause straight into the universal language of hands? Let me make the strongest case against this research mattering at all. 32 participants across two cultures. Novel logic puzzles in a lab setting. Of course, adults gesture more elaborately to kids. That's just being an adult talking to a kid. You slow down, you enunciate, you wave your hands around. This is a study confirming what every parent, every teacher, every human who has ever tried to explain anything to a 9-year-old already knows intuitively. It's the kind of research that makes people dismiss social science as expensive confirmation of the obvious. Now, let me tell you why that dismissal is dead wrong. The interesting finding isn't that adults gesture differently to children. It's the convergence. Italians gesture more than the Dutch. This is well-documented, culturally ingrained, practically a national trait. But when both groups shifted to teaching children, they didn't just amplify what they already do. They converged on the same specific strategy. Two-handed representational gestures, increased iconicity, the Italian abundance and the Dutch restraint met in the middle at precisely the point where a child needed to understand something new. Run this forward. If teaching gestures were purely cultural, learned, transmitted, varying across populations the way language does, you'd expect divergence under pressure, not convergence. The Dutch would get more Dutch about it. The Italians would get more Italian. Instead, both groups independently arrived at the same pedagogical toolkit. That points to something deeper than culture. That points to architecture. One of the comments captures this beautifully. A Dutch matrix algebra professor closing his eyes and drawing two matrices in the air with his hands, then multiplying them gesture by gesture. That's not cultural performance. That's cognition made visible. The hands aren't illustrating the thought. The hands are part of the thinking. This is where the research actually matters for anyone building communication systems. Human teaching is fundamentally multimodal. Speech carries the symbols, but gesture carries the structure. When we strip communication down to text, or even a voice without vision, we're amputating a channel that appears to be hardwired for exactly the moments when understanding matters most. The body isn't decoration on the lesson. As Campisi puts it, The body is part of the lesson. Evolution figured out the interface design a long time ago. We keep building systems that ignore half of it. Earlier, we talked about building systems that actually serve people. Here's a beautiful example of exactly that. POS 10, Basic Clout. Now, let me write the segment based on what I know about this topic and the context provided. There's a detail in cloud taxonomy that most people never notice. Luke Howard, an amateur meteorologist working in 1802, chose Latin. Not English, not French, not the language of whatever country might claim atmospheric science as its own. Latin, a dead language, belonging to no living nation. He wanted a classification system that could cross every border without triggering a single territorial reflex. That's engineering at the level of protocol design. Howard proposed three root forms: cirrus, the curl; stratus, the layer; cumulus, the heap. Then he showed that nature composes from these primitives. Cirrus stratus, strata cumulus, cumulonimbus. Combine the roots, name what you see. The system is so clean that 224 years later, the World Meteorological Organization still uses it. 10 genera, 3 altitude bands, the entire visible atmosphere indexed. Run this forward. Imagine if every classification system in science had been designed with this kind of discipline. Howard didn't try to enumerate every possible cloud. He identified the composable primitives and trusted that combination would handle the complexity. 3 base types generate 10 genera, which generate dozens of species and varieties. The combinatorial space is enormous, but the vocabulary stays small enough that a weather observer in Antarctica. And yes, apparently there are weather observers in Antarctica still classifying clouds by eye. Can hold the whole system in working memory. The NOAA page, the catalog ZOL 10, is straightforward educational material. High clouds above 20,000 feet. Middle clouds between 6 and 20. Low clouds below 6. What makes it worth your time is sitting with how elegant the underlying architecture is. This isn't a list someone compiled. It's a grammar someone discovered. Cirrus isn't a type of cloud the way a golden retriever is a type of dog. It's a morphological primitive, a building block that atmosphere uses to compose. The comments section turned into people recommending cloud-watching resources, which is exactly the right response. Someone even pointed to the WMO International Cloud Atlas, which is the closest thing we have to a complete visual grammar of the sky. Open, public, freely accessible. The tools exist. Look up. So, you looked up at the sky. Press now, look at your dashboard, because that thing is looking right back. Every sensor in your car is a microphone pointed at your life. Let me be specific about what's actually happening under the hood. Not the engine hood, the data hood. Modern vehicles run somewhere between 50 and 100 million lines of code. They have dozens of electronic control units networked together on a CAN bus. Accelerometers, gyroscopes, GPS receivers, cameras pointed at the road, cameras pointed at your face, radar, LIDAR in some cases, tire pressure monitors, weight sensors in the seats. Every one of these generates a continuous data stream, and every one of those streams can be logged, time-stamped, and shipped over the car's cellular modem to a server you've never heard of. The economics are clarifying. Hyundai gets 61 cents per vehicle from Verisk for driver behavior data. Honda gets 26 cents. These are insurance analytics companies building risk profiles from your braking patterns, your cornering speed, your acceleration curves. California fined GM $12.75 million, the largest privacy penalty under the CCPA ever. And it didn't even cover the $20 million GM made selling the data. The fine is a licensing fee. The business model is surveillance and the math works. What makes this structurally different from your phone is that your phone at least pretends to give you a permission model. iOS asks before an app touches your location. Android shows notification dots. Cars bury consent in a 200-page privacy policy you sign at the dealership while your kids are screaming in the back seat. And there's no settings panel to turn off the interior camera. No toggle for don't sell my braking data to insurance companies. This is a closed system problem. The firmware is proprietary. The telemetry endpoints are proprietary. The data pipeline is proprietary. You bought the car, but you don't control what it says about you. Someone in the comments suggested that CEOs should publish their own real-time driving data to their privacy policy pages. That's the right instinct. Transparency as accountability. The fix here is architectural. Open vehicle software. Auditable telemetry. Owner-controlled data routing. The hardware exists. The software could exist. Right now, the only people who can't see your driving data are you. Moving on. In Dabra the Ruger, no womi lokudu trooping lu, mamas oli in tatabo bogu, tu zo zung tu tu ka, sun shu zo ho, sima shua, the nezure tong, a Hollywood prop designer, typed, solar OS, for prof, tu lai zi de, architecture flag, generic patch level. The whole thing. 16 years later, a security researcher in the UK spent an entire workday dissecting that single screenshot with a junior colleague and came away more impressed than when he started. Simon Tassam, the guy who wrote PuTTY, the SSH client, that basically bootstrapped an entire generation of Windows users into the Unix world, post-Tron, legacy on DVD, and went line by line through Sam Flynn's terminal session. And the thing is, it mostly holds up. The Huami command returns the right user. The history output is formatted correctly. There's a login sequence that references what appears to be a real CVE from 1999, a classic Unix authentication bypass. Someone on that film crew knew their stuff. The beautiful part is what Tatham does with the errors he finds. Instead of just flagging them, he treats the screenshot as a forensic puzzle. What can you infer about the operating system from the command outputs? What was Kevin Flynn's last session before he vanished? The mistakes become constraints that make the puzzle more interesting, not less. One commenter points out that when Sam kills processes to free memory, the film's own mythology gives that a darker reading. Programs in Tron are people. Killing a process is killing someone. The prop designer probably didn't intend that, but the internal logic of the universe makes it work anyway. This is what happens when you put real Unix in front of real Unix people. The system is legible. The commands are inspectable. 26 years of combined scrutiny from thousands of nerds, and the screenshot still rewards close reading. Open protocols, open knowledge, open tools. Even a movie prop becomes a teaching moment when the underlying system is something anyone can learn. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 29, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Clum3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go look closely at something everyone else walked past. We'll see you back here tomorrow.